Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the No Laying Up podcast. Today's episode is going to be with Bruce Heppner of Heppner Golf Design. Bruce is in town doing some restoration work at the club that we play at, Timaquana Country Club here in Jacksonville, and has an impressive resume of working on golf courses basically most of his adult life. And for the last almost 30 years, he worked with Tom Doak for 17 years. You'll hear all about that on the podcast, and he's been all over the world, lived in all kinds of different places, worked on Ballyneal, Cape Kidnappers, Pacific Dunes, Renaissance Club. I mean, we could have done a lot more than 1 hour on just all the places he's been and places he's worked and the stories and whatnot. But I wanted to do a New Zealand episode. I was on that part of the trip solo. If you guys have seen our Tourist Sauce series, if you have not seen that, I do recommend you check that out on YouTube. 8 episodes, 6 of them in Australia, 2 in New Zealand. We also have a podcast that summarized the Australia leg, but haven't really broke down the New Zealand leg. Thought Bruce would be great to talk to on that, since he was basically in charge of building Cape Kidnappers. He's played down at Tara'iti, and he's been up to Kari Cliffs and has all kinds of stories about New Zealand as well. So that's kind of included within this, but also we talk about Pacific Dunes and experience out there at Bandon and all kinds of stuff. And man, Bruce has seen a lot, and I know I've learned a heck of a lot about golf course architecture from Andy Johnson at the Fried Egg, and from being fortunate enough to play at a lot of really cool places in the last couple of years. So it's really informative, at least for me, to sit down with a guy like Bruce, get his feedback on his philosophy on golf courses and design and restoration and all that. So I really enjoyed talking with him. I think you guys will enjoy it as well. I learned a heck of a lot in the process, and I imagine that you guys will too. So thank you for tuning in, and I think this is something you guys will enjoy. Before we get started, really quick, I want to give a shout out to our friends at Travis Matthew. Our main man Joe sent us a package here at the Kill House. I was not expecting it; just showed up one day. It was addressed. It had my name on it. It was addressed to me, and by the time I got to the box, there was only a couple items left in it, since the crew just ravaged through them picking out a bunch of stuff. They sent us a couple expat shirts, which are their polo shirt, which can be worn on the golf course, off the golf course. If you're tuning into the live show, you're going to see that I'm pretty much rocking Travis Matthew stuff in about 90% of the shots here. I wear their shorts every single day. Their t-shirts are my favorite. The Scully Athletic shirt is one of my favorites. And then they got a Recline Athletic shirt, the Streak shirt. I mean, this is what we wear off the golf course. And you can also wear the shorts perfect for off the golf course and on the golf course as well. So go to TravisMatthew.com, check those out. The summer has not left yet. You can still get plenty of wear out of the short sleeve and short stuff. So without further ado, here is our podcast with Bruce Heppner. Thanks for tuning in. All right, Bruce, we don't do a ton of golf course specific architecture on this podcast, but couldn't resist the opportunity to chat with you while you're in town here at Timaquana. So what brings you here? What brings you in town? What's the purpose of your visit here?
Well, I've been working with Timaquana Country Club for the last couple of years, and we did an extensive project last winter, restoring many of the classic features of Donald Ross, rebuilding the bunkers. We're back building a few tees this week and kind of connecting some chipping areas between some greens. So just back in for the week, dropping down from Traverse City and getting a little bit of work done.
How's the project? How's the plan like this work? Do you kind of make a proposal of what kind of changes you'd like to make? Does the club approach you and say, this is what we want to do? How did you end up getting this engagement, and what are the steps in that process like?
It's a little bit of both. You know, my reputation is now as a consultant. I work at restoring old golf courses of all types, all different architects. And so when they called me, I think they got references from different clubs that I was worked at a few Ross courses around the country, quite a few. And so came in for the interview, and a lot, you know, when I interview clubs, it's a push-pull a little bit. It's like, what do you want? And to me, it's investigating where they are, where were they at one time, and is it what's worthy of bringing back?
When it comes to restoration, and it seems to be clubs, almost every historic club in some capacity is going through some kind of restoration, Why do golf clubs need restored? What happens to golf courses over time that requires a restoration?
I think it's, you know, one, there wasn't a big reverence for the original architects until probably in the early 90s when I came into the business. A lot of us younger architects started studying great old courses. You know, I worked for Tom Doak, and he has traveled the world, and he realized that, you know, in the 70s and 80s, a lot of courses were remodeled or modernized. And so they were remodeled just for the sake of either harder or different, and they didn't really know who Donald Ross was, so there wasn't a lot of reverence to the original architect. So then, you know, we're studying some of these old drawings, and we're like, man, these courses were pretty good back then, and they really didn't need to be changed. Or, you know, neglect, like World War II, you know, filled in a lot of bunkers. So the more we study, now we think of Donald Ross and Alistair McKenzie and Albert Tellinghaus, these great architects. They're so great, you know, and they came out of that classic period, which was real strategic. They fit the golf course into the land. And so a lot of the restoration is putting back what they had originally done because it's still relevant today. You know, golf has changed a bit for really good players, but for the rest, you know, our average handicap at a club is an 18 now, and it was back then. So the courses are really relevant when you restore the features.
It's got to be. And the challenge you guys face these days with the modern equipment really, really, really helping the top most talented players and not really changing the game too much for the middle handicappers means you've got to almost design two golf courses in one.
That's true. And then you have to find out, like, who are the great players going to play your golf course?
Right.
You know, I've worked at probably, I probably have 40 great old classic clubs, and we've had a lot of state amateurs and good events. And I was telling them, what was the last score in your really good amateur event? And somebody might have shot close to par, maybe a little higher. And that's about it. So it's not like, unless you have the tour coming to town, these courses are really relevant for your average, really good amateur player. And they hold up really, even if it's 6,300 yards, they hold up because the greens are really good. You can tuck the pins, and they're not destroying these golf courses. So it's, you have to pick and choose when you restore who you're modernizing for or who you're worried about how the best players are. And sometimes they're not that good.
What is in your restoration work? What takes the most amount of time, or what is the most familiar, I guess, symptom of golf course erosion over time? Is it shrinking of greens? Is it restoring bunkers? What do you typically kind of specialize in, I guess, in that regard?
It's a little bit of everything, but it's mostly trees.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's restoring the widths, you know, the widths of the fairways to bring the bunkers back into play because they were out there. You know, back in the old days, they used to gang mow fairways. They were 40, 50, 60 yards wide, and the bunkers were out there on the edge. Then you get to a golf course, and they're 20, 25 yards wide, and the bunkers are irrelevant because they're way out in the rough. But it's a lot because of the tree lines. The trees have grown. You know, in the 60s, especially in the north, we lost our elm trees. American elm was a great American golf tree, high canopy, beautiful tree, and Dutch elm took them out. So a lot of clubs panicked, and they planted for their generation. So they planted Norway spruces, you know, soft maples that now, you know, they were playing in the 60s. Now they're dying off, you know, because their life expectancy is. So a lot of it's tree management. It's mowing management, getting the greens back out to the original sizes. And that's probably the most important thing you do.
When it comes to tree management, maybe that's not the issue that you run into the most with members, but I think, you know, people like their golf. A lot of members like a golf course the way that it is, and it's expensive to take trees out. Or correct me if I'm wrong, it's expensive to take trees out and whatnot. But I think when it comes to like an old course like Tim Aquana, it was built in 1923, it did not look like it currently does in the 20s, right? When Donald Ross laid this out, it was not. There's no these trees were not this size, right? So is it a difficult battle that you face in trying to convince people like this is not the original, I guess, intent of this golf course was to have this overgrown with trees?
It is a struggle. It's the hardest thing we do, but it's, you know, I build it with slow momentum. You know, we take out, first you take out agronomic trees. You blame a lot of things on agronomy. Open up air circulation around greens. You know, where the benefit of taking those trees down is sunlight, air circulation, and moisture. And so you can blame agronomy to fix things because the conditions are going to get better. So that's hard. That's the easy part. Next one are design trees where there's a tree in the middle of a fairway or something like that that really block a well-struck shot. You know, if you read any of the old books, written in the 1930s by Ross or Tillinghast. They always talk about trees as enhancing the game, not impeding in it. It should impede a well-struck shot. So I peel that layer away. It takes about 5 years to really correct a forest. And year three, people really understand you're just not out there hacking trees. You know, the tree lovers finally understand there's a rhyme to the reason. And then they understand, then you open up vistas, open up air circulation. And I always tell people, we just want the golfers to breathe again. And we're not cutting trees down, we're managing the forest. And the forest on golf courses need to be managed because it's a hyper environment. You know, we're adding moisture with irrigation, we're adding nutrients. And so the trees kind of grow exponentially than they would in nature. So you have to manage them.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it's a situation where people might think they don't want trees there, and then they're gone, and nobody's really like, they should put that tree back in, or there needs to be tree here. So you don't realize it until they're cleared how much things open up, and from an eye level standpoint. And for most members, golf doesn't need to be any harder than it already is. And in some way, it makes golf easier. You can still hit it in a bad spot where there used to be a tree. It's not a good place to be, but now you at least have a chance to recover.
That's correct. You know, a lot of the pushback I get is from really good players. Oh, you're just going to make it easier. I'm like, easier for who?
Yeah.
You're in the middle of the fairway.
Right.
You know, what I realize, they're selfish. They're like, they're giving, you know, 12 strokes to somebody. You're made it easier for them because they're recovering. But, you know, if you're in where the trees are and there's no trees there, you're in a really bad angle and you're probably going to catch a flyer. So it's not that much easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easier that, I tell people, it's easier that the group in front of you is playing 4 hours instead of 6 hours. So
what happens, I guess, when you are looking to do some kind of restoration and you look back and see maybe something that an architect did way long ago, maybe 100 years ago, that today you're like, you know what, I don't agree with that. Do you kind of pick and choose what you want to restore, kind of your own modern twist on a restoration? How does that process work?
No, you know, I think everybody, you know, it's still your interpretation of what somebody else did. And you're trying to apply what you've learned of classic principles to a golf course and apply them to a, you know, more of a modern setting. So I, you know, I'm more of a restorer. You know, I'm pretty faithful. You know, I work at quite a few top clubs, but I don't want my name involved in it. You know, I'm there, an archaeologist. I don't, you know, it's Donald Ross's course or it's Tillinghast's course. So I, you know, I just want to be lay in the weeds, restore much as possible, and give them all the credit and let it sit, because there's generally, it's all pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, when you peel through, I'm like, damn, these guys are really good. And I've learned a lot from them.
And, you know, it took me time to kind of fully realize, and honestly, just like listening to Andy Johnson over at the Fried Egg, he helps me realize things that I didn't know that I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I used to kind of think that hard golf courses were the best golf courses, mm-hmm. and were the most fun to play because of the challenge. And the more I started playing kind of these, you know, wider golf courses that let you choose routes, and it lets me get away with more shots, to be honest, how much more fun I had playing it. I'm like, what are we doing here with golf? What is golf? Golf is not necessarily a race to finish with the best score. It's like, I want to enjoy it from tee to green. I imagine that it seems to be kind of a whole and kind of a renaissance, which you worked for Tom Doak at Renaissance for. And I think that name was chosen for a reason, and that golf course architecture is in the last 20, 25 years is moving way more towards, this should be kind of fun for everyone. Is that a school of thought for you as well?
That's so true. You know, we're all decent players at one time, but we get off a bulldozer and go play golf, play matches. So we just play match play because, you know, you never know if you're going to have an eight or three on a hole. But we want it to be fun. You know, and that's what was the cool thing working for Tom is, you know, we built Sabonic and Ballyneal at the same time. And Sabonic, you know, was meant to be a hard golf course. They, you know, had some ownership and had Mr. Nicholas involved. And that was kind of the thought. It was hard. And Ballyneal, we were going completely the opposite. And I was out running Ballyneal, and we were just trying to make it fun and match play oriented. We don't even have tee markers. You know, whoever wins the hole gets to pick the tee ground. We just built tee ground. And so inherently, you know, the feedback of, you know, Sabonic's really good and everything, but they just go, man, it's really hard. And people that play Ballyneal just go, man, that place is so much fun to play. And that's, I think it's, people lose sight, it's a game.
Yeah.
And hard golf is one dimensional. Hit it down the middle of the fairway, hit the middle of the green, where wider fairways is angles. It's smarter golf, is wider golf, that you have to, you know, you play angles into the greens.
And I think where people can tend to get lost on it is when it comes to angles into greens, is the golf course kind of has to be designed from the green backwards.
Correct.
And that angle, if you just take a golf course and widen the fairways, like just take a narrow course and widen the fairways, that doesn't necessarily mean that you added strategical elements to it, no. Because the right side of the fairway might be as good as the left side. And it kind of took playing the old course to trigger that for me. Go. And yeah. You just look, go out there and that, you get to that second fairway and it's two fairways wide. I'm like, well, all the trouble's right. I'm just going to play into 17 fairway. This is easy. Why do they? This golf course is kind of dumb. And then you get to your shot and there's a huge hump between you and the hole and you can't get to it. It's like, okay, that was it. That was my shining light moment. Yeah. You gave two examples there, Sabonic and Ballyneal. And I want to kind of get in your background eventually, but if I'm, from my amateur understanding, that's about two polar opposites as far as your freedom to do what, I guess Ballyneal was kind of a blank slate to, mm-hmm. here's your canvas, do what you like with it. And Sabonic was much more of a dictation from the ownership group as to what kind of golf course they wanted and what kind of style. Am I accurate in saying that?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it was driven that, you know, it's in a steep neighborhood. It's right between Shinnecock and Draw Members. And it was, you know, it's a tough club to play, but it's a great club and it's a great golf course. It turned out really good. It's just it's, you know, it's leaning towards the harder side where, like I said, Ballyneal was destination. It's kind of like a Sandhills, mm-hmm. you know, out there and you're going to spend a bunch of time and have fun. So they're definitely opposite, but, you know, built by the same groups. You know, Tom was involved in both, obviously, mm-hmm. and it's kind of interesting how you could build two separate golf courses at the same time. And
well, before we get even more lost than we already are, I get a little carried away, I get excited, but I want to kind of get into your background, how you got into golf course architecture, design, restoration, your background into where you are now.
Well, I didn't get into the business until I was almost 30. You know, I was an auto designer for Chevrolet, went to school for a while, engineering degree, went back, and while I was in, I went to Michigan Tech, it was a civil engineering degree, and I read Ron Witten's book, The Golf Course, and has the biography of all the great architects. And I was kind of going through, and I'm like, man, I have all these guys actually have civil engineering degrees. I always played golf. I played all the other sports, but golf was something I loved to do. I loved the landforms. I was interested in building. And so I'm like, maybe I can get into this. And that's when about in the late 80s, was things started booming. So when I graduated, I sent about 200 to 250 resumes out to everybody. Had six job offers. And Ron Force, who's a big restoration guy, just started his business a year earlier. And Mike Hurgin got my resume and handed it to Ron. And Ron called me, and I'm like, this is a great opportunity. And joined him in 1990 and worked for him for 2.5 years. And we were just strictly doing restoration. We were like the first wave of guys that were starting to restore golf courses instead of remodeling. You know, Gil had just hired work with Tom, Gil Hans. Brian Silva just started doing restoration work, so it was like we were in the first ground level of that kind of work.
So in those 2.5 years, 3 years you worked at Force, what's your role? Are you in the bulldozers? Are you shaping, or what is kind of your role?
No, we were Ron was strictly an architect, okay. You know, so it was kind of architect associate. So I got to learn, you know, about the business, you know, being an associate, helping on projects, doing drawings, the basics. But the cool thing that I learned from Ron was the love of classic architecture. Ron and I would go on separate trips on projects, and you know, you go work on our golf course, do a master plan or something like that, and then you go visit five courses on that trip, and we come back and that's back when we all had cameras, you know, 35 millimeter cameras, and we'd show each other slideshows, and we'd spend hours in his office going through slides of greens and just studying why they were great. And, you know, one of the seminal moments of my life was the first time I saw pictures of the National Golf Links that Ron had just gone to. And I thought at that time Shinnecock was probably one of the great courses of the world. But lo and behold, I didn't know the greatest course in maybe the world was right next door. It just blew my mind, some of the crazy stuff that was going on. So, you know, that was the beauty of working for Ron, is like, gave me the love of classic architecture. The great old courses were good.
Why is National Golf Links the greatest golf course in the world?
I think it's, you know, you could probably ask any architect, I think of any reverence, Bill Coore, Tom Doak, any of us, that, and Gil Kanz, anyway, that's the first course they're going to say. Mm-hmm. Mainly because it's so complex. I always tell people, it's like you're playing chess or you're playing chess with Mr. Spock. Yeah, on three levels, that's the National. I don't care who you are.
Take for whatever people that have never been or won't ever go, take us there. What's it like? And
it's just, you know, C.B. McDonald was the original architect. He lived there. That was his great golf course. And he had time to tinker with it. He sent people overseas, Devereaux Emmett, to survey the great holes of the world, the Redan, the Biritz, the short hole, all the great holes that he ended up copying, and just influenced so much design into there, and so strategic that, you know, no matter who you are and no matter your ability, you have about two choices or three choices on every shot where to hit the ball. It just keeps getting higher level, where, like I said, simple hard golf architecture, you know, hard golf is just simple. Hit it the middle of the fairway, hit the middle of the green. The National, you know, there's so many different types of bunkering out there, different types of angles, the widths, the variety of the greens. They're so complex that it's so much fun because you always have to think your way around the golf course.
When you mentioned kind of looking at slideshows, looking at green surfaces and stuff, it was cool. What in your mind makes a good green surface? You kind of know it when you see it. Yeah. It's kind of, you see it and you're like, oh, that's a cool green.
Yeah.
Like, what are characteristics of a great green complex versus maybe an unappealing green complex?
That it's so complex that it's a different shot from different sides of the fairway. You know, different angles into them. When you tuck a pin on the right side, should be a different shot than on the left or in the back or the front. Just the variety of shots that you have to manufacture just to get close to a pin on that day. And that's, you know, great strategic golf, as you mentioned, starts from the green working backwards. So if the flag's on the right-hand side of the green one day, you're going to have to come in on the opposite side of the fairway that day, and you have to read where the flag is from the tee or if you pass by that hole earlier. So you plan your attack depending on where the hole location is. And if it's on the left, you might play the hole completely different. And all of a sudden, the bunkers on the right are in play. So it's that complex, you know, and it's high level. That's if you're hitting the ball straight. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even your highest handicapper, you know, if you're a good caddy, you can maneuver people around to avoid hazards and know the angles also.
See, I find if I'm, not as an overall rule, but if I have, you know, 5 10-foot putts over the course of a day and they're all like double breakers, I tend to think that there's just humps and bumps in greens for mm-hmm. no real reason or no real theme. Yeah. I love long contours to greens that I'm thinking about the contour of it from the fairway. But if there's humps and bumps kind of everywhere, the amateur player just doesn't, I can't work my way around just random humps and bumps on yeah. the greens. So it's kind of one of those things that's hard to describe, even my
own.
It's
an art.
But you look at something, you're like, that is a cool green. I was wondering if you had a way of kind of thinking about it. And honestly, listening to Tom and Andy's podcast, just hearing him kind of say certain things about, like, I don't want people aiming at flags from the fairway. I'm like, oh, man, that is a cool way to kind of think of a way to design a golf course.
Tom and Bill Coor will be, I still think, good in history, will be the greatest putting green builders ever. You know, they're so complex and they're so different, but the greens have such great variety and there's such thought of the shots into it. You know, when you're building a green for Tom, he's just coming, he's grinding around it and he's thinking about shots, all the different shots, even recovery shots. You know, when you're average golfer at a club that actually holds a handicap as an 18 handicap, that means they're missing 18 greens. So Tom's always thinking about recovery mm-hmm. and, you know, the different shots and recovery shots that, you know, that he lets you have.
How did you end up working with Tom? How did that process work? I mean, you worked with him for, what, 17 years?
17 years. I was his vice president. Tom, you know, I always kind of knew the myth of Tom when he was young. He's this, you know, young guy. Then he started building High Point up in northern Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. So I knew about him. And even when I was college, I knew about him and called him a couple times. And, you know, he was just kind of doing his thing, just left Pete. And then I knew Gil Hans was like one of his associates early on. And I was working for Ron. And then I heard, you know, I kind of struck up a friendship with Ron, Gil Hans. And I knew he was just about to leave Tom. So I was looking to get back to Michigan eventually because, my wife is from Michigan and we wanted to move back. And I was going to go work for kind of a mid-level architect, Jerry Matthews, out of Michigan. And Tom caught word of that, and he goes, no, you're going to come work for me. I'm like, perfect. You know, so I got, you know, dream come true. I got to live in Traverse City, which I used to, you know, holiday as a kid, and then work for, I knew who was going to be the next big thing. You know, I just knew Tom was that smart. Mm-hmm. So I caught him early, and we were still just doing restoration, and he'd built High Point in a few courses, but nothing really big. So even for the first 3 years, we hadn't built a new golf course. We were just kind of living off the restoration and remodeling stuff. And then, boom, struck it pretty good and built Pacific Dunes. And then it was off to the races. We had a pretty good run there for a while, and he still has a great run. But, you know, I was pretty fortunate. I was right there in the middle of it all.
From your perspective, and can we ask, you just kind of mentioned something about green design and thinking of recovery shots, but from your perspective, what makes Tom Doak great?
He just understands golf. You know, it's, you know, you see a lot of golf courses being built out there, and I see them all, and I'm like, man, it's quite not quite there. You know, they did, maybe didn't get the golf, but they got the eye candy. The bunkers are brilliant. Tom was always about routing in the greens, and understanding the shots, and making it fun and interesting. He's just that smart at it. And then he understood. He created a creative process that we nurtured with amongst us associates. He had Jim Urbina, myself. You know, now he's still got Brian Slonick, Schneider, Eric Iverson, who are some of the best guys in the business. You know, those guys are really talented, and they're all really smart. And he just created a creative culture where Tom would get the routing in, and he'd always have one guy running, and the other guys are shaping it. And we'd just ask him a few questions. He'd just give you enough information to give you enough rope to go build what you think is best. And then he's a brilliant editor. He'd come in and you think you nailed something really good, and he'd come in and within 20 minutes make it 10 times better. It's just, you know, that kind of a mind.
So what was the you mentioned Pacific Dunes kind of being the thing that really jump-started things. What was, take me through that process. What was the first time you guys saw that property? And, I mean, was it just a million options and kind of overwhelming as to what you could do with that land?
I
mean,
Tom and I originally walked the property. Mike Kaiser said, you know, David Kidd was about to start Bandon Dunes, but hadn't started it yet. And Tom had some connections through Chicago and befriended Mike Kaiser. Mike said, well, you can go out and look. So Tom and I went out to the superintendent show in San Francisco. We flew up to Bandon. And David had just started cutting center lines through the gorse. And so Tom and I went up and spent 2 days on it, walking around. Just amazing, you know, property. And there was a barbed wire fence. And Tom and I go, we asked the caretaker, Shorty Dow, hey, can we go over and look? He goes, no, you can't go over. That guy's got a gun, you know. And I told Tom, we got to go there. We lost Shorty somewhere, and Tom and I snuck over a barbed wire fence and looked over to the dune and saw Pacific Dunes right there. And Mike had us looking at a property south of Bandon, which is lower property. And when we reported back to Mike Kaiser, Tom said, we'd be, you know, if David doesn't do good, you know, we could fill in, but you really should think about buying that property to the north. And a couple of years later, Mike called and said the guy foreclosed, and I bought it. And then David hogged some of the property, built a couple holes into it. And it was just, we knew it was going to be a life changer for all of us. I remember the first time Urbina and Tom and I were out there. I think Don Plasek flew with us out. And we just knew, you know, it was like, this is going to be a game changer for all of us. We'd all been big fans of the Sandhills, which we thought was a big game changer. We knew this was going to be a big one. And we never took it for granted. We knew the responsibility we had on our shoulders.
So you guys were very confident that people were going to show up and play at this remote location. It's easy to say now, but at the time, it was very much.
Well, they already had. You know, it was interesting. While we were building Pacific Dunes, you know, Bandon was open, and the lodge was open. We stayed at the lodge. And, you know, in the wintertime, Mike, you know, cut the rates. He didn't think anybody would come down in the winter because it's raining up in Portland and Seattle. Man, they came down in droves. I mean, you can't play golf in Portland when it's raining. You could play in Bandon because of sandy soils. So it was successful year-round, and actually almost really more successful in the wintertime, mm-hmm. because it brought – people would come down and play golf. And so, you know, I don't think Mike even knew it could be that big a success. But we knew, you know, by living there, how popular Bandon was, and we knew how good ours was going to mm-hmm. be. And we had all the confidence in the world it was going to be that great, and it turned out that good.
What were the holes that David built into the property into Pacific? Was it 6 and 7?
Yeah, he just hogged right into that. But rightfully so.
Yeah.
6, 7, and 8, I think, was over the fence.
Okay. So how does that – you see this incredible piece of property. Obviously, your eyes are going towards the shore, I would think, or towards that coast. I've always looked at, you know, designing a golf course like a puzzle piece and whatnot. Do you design from the coast backwards? Do you start drawing out holes? Like, what is also like maybe an example of something that almost happened at Pacific Dunes that ended up not happening? Because I mean, I imagine you can draw out a perfect hole and you're like, oh well, now I can't use that part or whatnot. I mean, how did you guys come up with?
I'm trying to think. You know, it's because Tom would always hog the maps. He did the routing first, and he'd give it to us, and it was pretty hard to improve on.
Yeah.
But, you know, routing a golf course, you have to have a lot of things in your mind. You know, that's what Tom's a math genius, too. And so it's a lot of math work. It's like knowing the 18 holes. You got to have this many pars in there, length. And you're trying to get all the angles of the clock or of the compass. You're always taking advantage of backdrop. You know, we learned that from McKenzie. You always had a great backdrop behind a green. It wasn't coincidence that there's a mountain behind that green. Mm-hmm. So there's all these factors, and then getting back are you bringing nine holes back, or are you going out 18 in a loop? That's why, you know, Pacific Dunes, you know, Tom took some chances. They have two par threes in a row, but it fit. You know, he was just looking for the great piece of ground. He's looking for 18 great holes that fit into that land. And there was some bridge. You know, you had the primary dune right along the water. And then you had some flat ground, and then you had the secondary dunes, you know, up high. So you had to bridge between the two, you know, so 4 and 12 kind of bridge those gaps, 15.
Give you a peek at the ocean on the way out. And
but it's, you know, you get, it's great drama. You get out there and then you go away from it, you get back out again. So you don't want to hog it all at one time. You got to loop out to it and back. You know, we learned that from, you know, Bally Bunyan, places like that. That's why going out and studying great golf courses, right. That's how you learn from them. Mm-hmm. You know, and you don't shoot it all at one time. You want to get glimpses, so you go to the ocean as many times as you can and get away from them.
And Bannon does that as well.
Bannon does it really well,
fourth
too.
Fourth hole, 4, 5, 6, and then 12 goes back out, and then 15, 16, and whatnot. So what is, you know, we've all read Tom's confidential guide on golf books and kind of confidential guide on golf courses, and seeing how much travel and stuff he's done. Have you personally done a lot of travel around seeing courses, learning from courses? Is that encouraged by Tom?
That's
when you
totally
work
encouraged
for him?
By him. Yeah. You know, we've all done it. You know, just working for him, you get to travel. You know, I've lived in New Zealand, Mexico, Scotland. You know, we've been all over the world. And while you're at it, you're also going out studying. So I've played pretty much all the great courses of the world early on when I was working for Tom. And then we all have. And, you know, and Tom expects that of you, because when you're coming up, you know, you're about to build a green, he's like, I'm thinking about the 15th at Riviera, you know, on this green. So it just kind of gives you a little glimpse of what he's thinking, mm-hmm. and you build it, and then he comes and edits it. But, you know, he has that in his mind. This is kind of the concept I'm thinking of. It worked here, this green with this fairway. And so you have a pretty good glimpse of what's going on. You go build it, and then he edits it. But he wants you to know all those things.
And if I'm getting to correct me if I'm not steering along the path, but the next big you did Ballyneal, is that after Pacific Dunes?
Yes.
And then and then you went to Cape Kidnappers and did in New Zealand, or was there more in between that? I'm sure there was.
Yeah, because you know, the progression was Pacific Dunes kind of put us over the map, but you know, we'd built some, you know, Beechtree and some riverfront and Lost Dunes. A lot of, you know, we were building them in threes. Mm-hmm. It seemed like, and then you know, the next three were, I think, like Ballyneal, Sabonic, and I think Lost Dunes were at the same time. We had Rock Creek, Apache. You know, we were being in groups.
Sure.
And then I think Cape Kidnappers was the big one that took us all over. You know, all the associates went over. We all shaped. I ran the project. That was the first one where we all went and just had the time of our lives.
I was going to say, that's the one I'm maybe most excited to talk about, yeah. I think. So I made the mistake of playing Cape Kidnappers 2 days after playing Terra Edie. So yeah. It was otherwise
a little less underwhelming.
Well,
but
that's
still
the
great thing.
That some of the shock value was taken away, which is a shame, but it's still like one. And I was kind of, I went in kind of purposely pretty blind to it. Obviously, I've seen the pictures of the back nine and whatnot. Yeah. And the more when I walked away, I was like, man, I really wish I would have shot more footage on the front nine. I mean, the front nine is almost, I think, defines the course more than the back nine does. There's so much intrigue to all the golf holes that go through that front nine. So I want to hear was the job already accepted and you guys were doing it, but the first time you saw the property, or how did that work?
At
Cape, yeah.
Tom had flown, Julian Robertson is the owner from New York, Tiger Hedge Fund. Played Pacific Dunes, or went to Bandon and went to play Bandon Dunes, and they said, sir, we can't, we're going to make you play Pacific Dunes, and he threw up fit because he didn't. He's like, I came here to play Bandon Dunes. Like, no, you know, it's full, but we're going to put you in.
You'll
so
be played, fine.
Yeah, you'll be fine. And he was really mad. By the end of the round, he goes, who built this? And he goes, he had a second course because he had already built Curry Cliffs. So he contacted Tom, flew him down, which is not a quick flight.
Sure.
And helicoptered into the project, and obviously it's a spectacular site.
For those that haven't seen it, take us to this site. What is
it? Cape Kidnappers is basically a peninsula that juts out in the Pacific Ocean. It's about 300 feet above the ocean, and at the tip is like a tooth, you know, at the end where the gannets live. And it's just a big, they call them sheep stations. It's a sheep farm, but it's a 5,000 acre sheep farm up on a cliff, up on a high plateau. But there's one little plateau there where there's huge, deep 100-foot ravines where we were able to shoehorn a golf course into. And the ground is actually pretty flat where you play the golf. But it's, Tom accepted the job. I said, I want to be in charge, fly my family down. So I went down and, you know, the road going up there, we call it 14 stream crossing. It was a stream and it was a two track and you're going through the stream 14 times to get up there. So every day it would take 45 minutes to get to the site.
45 minutes.
Yeah, every day.
Well, when I went there, I rang the buzzer from the main road to the property and I said, yeah, I got a tea time. Come on up. And the guy said, drive safe.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I'm here. I'm here. I'm ringing the buzzer here. He's like, yeah, drive safe. And it was about a 20-minute drive from the main road.
Yeah, it's a 5-kilometer drive winding up and down this this stream valley. And, you know, it took a year and a half to build the road to get into it. But every day we drove up in a two-track. And, you know, I'd been up there by myself early on. And, you know, if you got too much rain, you either were going to get stuck up there or you didn't go up. And, it's just a spectacular sight.
Were there concerns when Tom saw it for the first time, whether or not you could get equipment up there to build it?
Yeah, we had all those concerns. Yeah. We had a lot. Did we helicopter? You know, we actually helicoptered the bunker sand into it. It was cheaper to helicopter, you know, pick up at the bottom in these tankers and drop it into the bunkers because it was easier than bringing the semis up.
Jeez.
So it was a logistic nightmare getting up there, especially the road was under construction while we were building it. So we, you know, there was traffic jams. You were stuck an hour, you know, halfway up the hill because they were building a bridge. So it was a difficult place to get to. Once you got up on top, the golf holes kind of laid in there. But we had to build some pretty expensive bridges that had 200 or 300 foot spans that go from one ravine across a ravine to the other.
When you saw the fingers of the cape where the back nine is stretched, was it as simple as, oh, there's a golf hole, there's a golf hole? Did it take some kind of convincing to build holes out into those fingers?
Well, you could get out to them, but you didn't know how to get back.
Yeah.
So they weren't wide enough to have two holes. So you knew you had to get out and jump across the ravine, and we knew that was going to be expensive. So it was simplifying as much as you could to get to the ocean as many times as you could without, you know, breaking the bank and building these gigantic bridges, which we did. So it was a very efficient routing. But, you know, the beauty is the inland holes were just as good as the holes with the views. Like you said, there's some great ground, especially in the inland holes.
And so much of that is probably lost on visitors. It was to me going into it because I had no expectations.
Yeah, those first six holes are really, really good.
Yeah.
You know, and then great pieces of ground. We didn't move a lot. You know, Tom was coined the father of minimalism even when he was 20 some odd years old. But you know, people don't realize minimalism is like save as many holes as you can that are natural grade and then move the world to make the other three great. Mm-hmm. And so
interesting.
We would have disguised moving the world on some of those holes. You know, the beauty is, you know, the biggest compliment is to me is even like at Stream Song, you didn't know where we moved the dirt, you know, because we knew how to go wide enough to tie it into nature. So there wasn't like a zipper around the golf hole, like, oh, you started here. We don't want you to know where we started, where we had to move the big amount of dirt. And Cape Kidnappers, we filled some valleys in and, you know, built some green sites that were on little volcanoes. You just don't know it because we were dedicated to make the whole place seamless.
How do you, those holes on the back nine, 10, 12, 15, and really 16, too, in the opposite direction, how do you what's the thought process going to design those two holes for the two extreme winds you might face there? I mean, that is an exposed piece of property. Those winds are extreme up there.
Look, 15 is sometimes unplayable. You know,
it was 650 dead into the wind.
We had the Renaissance Cup, Tom's big tournament there, and it was howling wind. And 15, you know, we had two person match play events, two man teams, and one person would finish the hole because the wind would howl so much. So I remember hitting like 2-iron, 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 2-iron putter, you know, and hitting a 2-iron 100 yards if you could. And it's just the nature of the site. And you knew one day a week when the winds would shift, that was going to be really difficult. But the other days were just spectacular. So you just had to accommodate, you know, you tried to make the holes as wide as you could. You understand where the prevailing winds were. and hope he didn't catch a bad one.
Jeez. I mean, what do you, when you guys got the site that you were super excited about it, you wanted to lead it. What was most appealing to you about that project?
One, New Zealand.
Yeah.
There's a romantic quality about New Zealand. Everybody has.
Like, say, what makes New Zealand great to you?
It is. It's just the great variety. You go 100 miles and you're in a different national park. You know, you think the entire country would be, Teddy Roosevelt would have made the whole place in a national park. And just the diversity, from the tip, the northern tip is tropical, to the southern tip, there's penguins. And everything in between, the South Alps and, the wine country, it's just it's the size of California, but so diverse.
How long did you live in New Zealand?
A year and a half.
Yeah. Where did you live?
Right there at the base. Teawanga was just right at the base of the hill. And I was living in, my wife and my 5-year-old son was with me. So we got rented a cottage right in a winery.
Sounds like you want to go back.
It was pretty cool.
Do you go back to New Zealand often, or have you been back?
I've been back. I did follow up, post-construction, the Renaissance Cup. And then I think I've been back 3 times. I've been back when we had the Renaissance Cup at Terry Eady a couple of years ago. Okay. I was back.
That's what I was going to ask next about Terry Eady. Had you seen Terry Eady? What is your? I do my best to try to tell people, explain it to people, and
they have a hard time.
I don't think I've found the proper words.
Most people
for it.
One, haven't heard about it. Two, and I tell people I literally think it's the greatest golf course in the world, and people are like, "What?" I'm like, "Well, I didn't have anything to do with it," but it's. It's really the most magical settings because you have the mountains out in the I always call it Dr. Nose Layers out there in the ocean, those mountains, those islands out there. You have the best climate. You have one of the most, prettiest sites. We stole the superintendent from Pacific Dunes. They have some of the best fescue fairways in the world. The design is out of it. I've never seen anything that complex and that cool before. Brian Slonick ran it. Brian's a dear friend, and he was one of my original interns and one of the smartest guys I know, and his brilliance is all over it. Tom's brilliance. It's just everything about it, it was the best I'd ever seen of its kind of subject.
It's like all what makes all these kind of great modern designs cool in their own way, all like kind of combined into one.
Yeah, it's like everything they knew for the last 25 years, and we're able to pour it into one project. And I thought Pacific Dunes was the perfect project, and I thought Ballymena was the perfect project. Mm-hmm. But this is, and it's so quiet, so private. You're allowed to play it once, and then you have to join it. So it's real, secluded. The owner's great. They understand it. Understated clubhouse. I remember playing one afternoon after post-Renaissance Cup, I was playing with Brian Palmer from Shore Acres, and we planned to go out and play 9 holes or 6 holes. It's right by the gun. They'll go body surfing for 6 holes and come back. It's
the setting is like, I said, it felt a bit like walking into the Truman Show, and that ocean looks a little bluer than it does
perfect
in other places.
Waves. It's perfect waves. Set.
And the sound sounds like amplified in it. You honestly feel like you're playing golf in a simulation.
It truly is. We the evening of the Renaissance Cup, they have a cocktail party out front, and they had this perfect set of waves coming in. It was a perfect curl, like a 10-foot curl, and all of a sudden there's dolphins jumping in, and somebody says, "Cue the dolphins," And it was literally like that's what it is—the Truman Show, and it's literally man-made. All the contours are man-made, and it's. Brian had, they called the art department, the set of three young guys that are brilliant young associates and young interns that were really into artwork and making it beautiful and natural looking. And it's some of the funnest shots I've ever seen on a golf course. You have to, I played a bunch with Brian while I was there. He's my partner. And then we just played a bunch of golf together out there. And he's like, aim it over there, 30 yards over there, and watch it feed on it. So all the really cool alternate shots were there, and sometimes it weren't the obvious. Like Tom told Andy, he's like, sometimes I don't want to aim at a flag. Sometimes you're aiming 30 yards left and watch it feed in.
Right, with wedges.
With wedges. It's pretty fun.
Yeah.
It's just interesting and fun.
That's what, the 11th hole is a par 5 there, and I played with Jim Rohrstaff out there, and he just said, all right, play it 40 yards short and left, and just watch it disappear and roll up on there, and it did. And then – the 12th hole, par four, had wedge in. He's like, play this off that hill to the right of the green. Don't go at that pin. In. And what we were at Barnburg Lagoons about a week before that, and one of the, I guess, criticisms we had of that was that it just didn't quite play like it looked like the slopes wanted you to play. The greens were just a bit furry, and the slopes were just a bit furry. And that's what I blows my mind about golf course design is you guys come up with these percent grade slopes that, you know, you're putting into a course, and you don't really know how it's going to play until the grass is grown in and how you get something. Because once it's built, you can't, I mean, it's pretty difficult to just bulldoze it and change the grade.
Hand over the keys, basically.
Half a percent. Yeah. So how does it even, I imagine it's just so much experience that comes into saying like, all right, if I want this slope to the right of this green, it has to be this grade and it can't be 1 degree off of that or else it kind of ruins the whole design.
You got to trust the superintendent. You're hoping they can maintain what you are trying to design. You know, luckily we knew we had, you know, CJ out there. We already knew from Pacific Dunes. So we weren't worried about the turf conditions and the firmness. So you could pull off those shots, and that doesn't always work. You know, sometimes the grass gets a little, you know, you either get a new owner or the owner wants it greener than we thought it would be. We needed a little browner and a little firmer. And so sometimes the shots don't work.
Yeah. Had you, during your time in New Zealand, did you visit Kauri Cliffs?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. What did, were you trying to learn something in that regard to kind of how to fit a golf course into an extreme landscape, or what was kind of the takeaways you had from Kauri Cliffs?
One, we knew, you know, that was the first place we went. And when Tom and I landed in New Zealand, all of a sudden there's a helicopter waiting for us, which was pretty cool.
They are not close together.
No. And, you know, Julian was putting on the show, and he flew up in a helicopter to the Kauri Cliffs and, you know, toured it and landed and played it. And, you know, Kauri Cliffs is really good. It's on a really severe piece of ground. And David Harmon, I think, did a great job. He's passed away since, but it's a more of a modern design. You know, they weren't thinking about the ball running here and there. You know, it's a highly maintained golf course. It's pretty, you know, but it's a pretty setting up there in the Bay Islands. And so it fits it really well. I think what we learned more about it was from our client, you know, what our client was and what we needed to. And, you know, even before I flew out to New Zealand, Tom sent me out to the Hamptons. Julian, you know, has a place out there, and he's a member at National in Shinnecock. And I spent 2 days with him just picking his – he goes, go out and pick his brain what he likes about the National and what he likes about Shinnecock. So we can kind of figure out what we could get away with, you know, what we could – you know, what would be acceptable in his mind, and did he want a big lush place? You know, what, you know, could we – you know.
Yeah.
What was his knowledge
base? What are you
about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think that was mostly because we didn't really copy much from Kauri Cliffs other than, you know, we had some of their project managers and their construction crew come up and their maintenance guys. So we got to go know them and learn from their mistakes or their successes and how we could apply it at our place.
And that one of the things I took away from Kauri Cliffs was how they used, in the way they used the land, a lot of your really severe climbs. First of all, you need a golf cart out there.
Sure. Yeah.
But a lot of the climbs, a lot of difficulties are in between holes. Like the golf holes themselves have, there's a couple holes. I think the fifth or sixth hole is a par four that really goes uphill. But the rest of them don't play too extreme from up or down over this crazy wild property.
He did a good job. He laying, you know.
And there's some bridges there too that are,
you know,
enormous.
And, you know, you can build a golf course in real severe ground and just not be even playable. It just could be a big dumb golf course. And he got a working good golf course on real severe ground.
Mm-hmm. Did you go down to the South Island, Jack's Point at all while you were there?
No, but you did play Arrowhead or Arrowtown. You know, it was interesting. You know, when you run a project for Tom, you're kind of a slave to the site because you want to be. You're running, and on Sundays I'd be up there by myself or take my kid up in shape. And my wife, my son got to travel all over New Zealand while I was living there. I didn't get to see much because the shapers always were going on trips and stuff. Weekends away with their wives, and I was always kind of slave to it. But since then, I've gone to travel a lot and see the rest of it, and more just be a tourist than see anything in golf. But you know, Pereperu was great. We played that.
Okay.
And, you know, there's some great golf still there, but you know, I think the Cape and Terry Eater are kind of heads and shoulders above.
Yeah,
you know, it was kind of funny. Like the local Jack Nicklaus was building course up in Taupo, and my landlord was like, well, Jack's going to build something better than you because he's the greatest course in, you know, golf in the world. And I'm like, I think you're going to be surprised how good this is going to be.
Yeah.
He just thought we were a bunch of yahoos from the United States. He thought it was really arrogant. I'm like, no, this can be really good. It's going to be pretty well known in the world. And I think when it popped into whatever, 25th or something in the world, I sent him a note. I'm like, I think we did pretty good.
We did all right.
Yeah,
yeah, there's a lot happening with New Zealand golf, especially with Te Reiti and, you know, potentially two new courses going in there at Te Reiti.
Darn
and
right.
That's going to be a true – I mean, it, as of now, and we just kind of did a video series on it. I mean, I played three courses on the North Island, and I mean, it's 9 hours of driving between them. It's not like the Sandbelt where you throw a blanket over.
You just go there and play golf.
Eight world class courses. It's not a true golf destination just yet. But
no, it isn't. You know, people would ask me, I'm like, well, go and rent because you're gonna want to go on holiday in New Zealand. If you can sneak it around to golf in one of the courses, great. But it's not really a golf destination. But it's getting there now. They're getting there.
Yeah, they definitely are. What, you know, you mentioned some of the travel you've done and all the different places you've lived and stuff, but what I'm wondering in your travels, what is a place or a series of places you've seen that have had the most influence on you?
It was going to the Sandbelt to Australia.
Yeah.
It changed my life quite a bit. You know, it was, we were on tourist visas. We were in New Zealand. So I don't know if we were illegal aliens or what, working there, but we, you know, every 3 months we had to bug out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And might as well go to Melbourne and play golf.
I gotta go to Melbourne.
Dang it, I hate to do that. So we'd go over there and play golf. You know, I'd set up, I knew Mike Clayton really well, and so we set up great golf trips over there, and we'd go for a week and play everything. And the biggest thing for as a consultant now was the mowing lines in all the sandbelt courses, you know, how they mowed, you know, greens out to right to the edge of the bunkers, how they mowed from chipping areas and then the next tees. You know, Kingston Heath is brilliant, mm-hmm. Woodlands. So I learned how to kind of apply that over here, where Ballynail was a product of that. You know, was I came back from New Zealand, my hair was on fire. I'm like, man, now I know how to make some cool stuff in some sandy areas. So Ballynail was a direct product of that, where you were always walking on short grass. You could almost walk the whole golf course on short grass. You know, we connect fairways or chipping areas to the next tees, into the next fairways, into the next green. So it was just a contiguous. You know, and Te Reiti is that, you know, connected fairways.
Can play with a putter by technicality.
Yeah, so all those courses after that, we kind of, that was a big mantra in the back of our minds to make things even cooler.
Yeah, I think something that triggered me was when we were at Royal Melbourne, and they had, and forgive me because I don't remember the grass types, and I'm not an agronomical expert by any means, but they had different, the landing areas in front of the greens were a different surface than the fairways because they wanted you to be able to play runoffs, and that was like, oh, now we're talking. Like now we're thinking about, you know, how to combine the playability of a course with like grass types. And I think kind of transitioning a little bit towards, you know, we watch a lot of professional golf. You see a lot of professional golf and how different those courses that they play are from the courses that I've enjoyed playing the most. And so almost everything comes back to two things to me. One, it's technology. They have to go to golf courses that, you know, can handle these guys pounding drivers 330. And two, it just comes down to courses playing fast and firm or playing the way, like Scotland golf to me, and people listening to this podcast have heard me rave about it to a nauseating extent, is golf. Like that, playing target and kind of throwing it in the air and stopping it in the next place is not nearly as fun. But kind of walk in the most broad way, take us through why like a PGA Tour golf course is not going to play fast and firm like that we would ideally want.
One, I think the tour is sports entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, it is entertaining. Yesterday was pretty entertaining.
Oh, my God, it was.
And so, you know, they want these guys to look good. They are good. They're that good. Mm-hmm. You know, they just hit a ball on a dime and far and straight now. And so they want them to shine. They want them to be a pretty package on TV. So, you know, when you see – Royal Liverpool, that's just brown or anything, even Gullin when it was baked, people have a hard time looking at that, you know, in the States, and just like, where's the fairway?
Right.
Where's the green? And watching the ball roll out 400 feet. But, you know, what was interesting at Carnoustie is that I don't know if it necessarily played good links golf because the greens and the approaches were wet.
Very wet, yeah.
And so it was just hard because Carnoustie's hard. And you got to keep it in the fairway. But they were hitting it 400 yards and then throwing wedges on, you know, and spinning the ball back.
Right.
So I don't think it worked really well there. But it's compelling to watch. I don't know. You know, I just think it's sports entertainment, and it's watching pretty golf on TV. You know, we see it every April, and when it's like Dorothy coming out of the you know, black and white to color, you watch Augusta.
Well, it's just that you've worked on so many sites here, just looking at your resume of places that in the States that do it really well. And like I said, the most entertaining golf I played is in Scotland. All those links courses essentially kind of play in some way, play the same way. They're all designed for just the ball to be rolling on the ground. And going out, I went to Bandon for the first time 5 years ago, first links golf experience ever. Played it, and I just kind of wondered, like, all right, is that links golf or is that American links golf? Went and played in Scotland and went back to Bandon this past year. Bandon holds up.
Maybe even better.
It is links golf.
Ken Nice is that good, that superintendent out there, and he really gets it.
And honestly, it is that feeling of hitting an iron off that turf and the sound that the ball makes when it hits the green are the two things that like triggered to me. Like, that is kind of just – that's golf. Like, that is totally golf. So how – I guess I don't really have a question related to it. It's just that trying to highlight – what are the best places in the States that do that style of golf? And you seem to have worked on maybe 90% of them. Yeah.
You know, and it's necessary for the design. You know, we love that kind of golf,
sure.
You know, because it's fun. If you have to land a ball, you know, 150 yards out, and you know you have to land it 30 yards short and read the ground, what the ground feed it in. I think, you know, what they always say is like I think it's American golf, you can breathe a sigh of relief when the ball hits the ground. And over in Scotland, you stop breathing when the ball hits the ground
because
you got 10 more seconds of excitement. But you read the ground. You let the ground move the ball instead of the ball moving in the air. Where professional golf is mostly moving the ball in the air and picking a target and hitting the perfect shot because I read it right and it is the perfect shot. But links golf is creating the perfect shot and landing it anywhere you want and reading the ground. You know. Five different guys can take a different avenue to the same spot, you know, just by maneuvering the ball, the flight of the ball, using the ground on the left or the ground on the right to feed it in. You know, we're pretty fortunate that that's the kind of golf we love to play. Mm-hmm. And so it's sandy-based soils. So Tom was on a pretty good run and getting some great sites. So Pacific Dunes obviously was the first one. You know, the Sandhills was the start one. That started it all for Bill and Ben and got us all realize we could build something cool like that. And then, you know, Stream Song works really well. Yeah. Rusty Mercer, amazing that he, in the wintertime, can get Bermuda to play that way, blows us all away. If you go play Stream Song here in Florida in the middle of January when the Bermuda's a little dormant, you're putting from 100 yards out, and it works.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, that's great.
And that's the key. You said it, the sandy soil. I mean, as much as, like, we would love every golf course to kind of play fast and firm and interesting like that, but the key is the soil. You can't just build in the middle of Ohio a links golf course.
But you can do it on clay soil. You can firm up clay. It's just as long as it drains well. You get the water off the clay. And clay, obviously, when it gets wet, it gets a little mushy, but firm clay soil can run ball pretty well too. But sandy soil is obviously the best because it's always going to be dry and drains really well.
You mentioned Stream Song. What was Florida is famous for being incredibly flat and uninteresting land for the most part. What was your reaction when you guys saw the land that would?
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's that was the last project I worked for Ron or for Tom on, and I remember driving there the first time, and you're going through flat mining fields basically and pretty flat territory, and all of a sudden you get to this, you come over a hill, and you think you're in Sandhills in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember when early on in construction, I had Ron Witten, Brad Klein, had all the writers come by, and I always loved coming over to the 10th hole of the red course because our maintenance facility was there, and hearing the gasps in the back seat just go, oh my gosh, you know, where are we?
Because it was wild. I mean,
it was crazy.
It was like, I'm not swamp, but there was wildlife out there.
It was wildlife. You know, Florida reclaims things pretty fast, you know, because of the year-round vegetation growth. So it was an old mining site, and they just plopped the dirt everywhere and had open pits and filled full of water. And Florida had gained, you know, Mother Nature had reclaimed the land pretty fast. So what I always told people is, like, it reminded me of the early pictures of Pine Valley. If you look at the early pictures of Pine Valley when there were no trees, it was lakes, vegetation, and sand. And that's what Stream Song looked like when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Tom and Bill worked on the routing brilliantly together and separately and then back together again and milked the most out of that landform. man-made but unique landform and twist it into something that could be natural.
And you don't feel like it's man-made when you're there. No. Definitely not.
No, because, you know, because wind and nature had taken it over, so it kind of softened the edges. And you know, we moved a bit of dirt on certain holes again. Mm-hmm. We disguised it, but for the most part, a lot of it was there, and it's a pretty cool place.
What and then after that, you mentioned that was the last project you worked on with Tom. You went out. What encouraged you to want to go out on your own?
And, well, Tom, like a year before, Jim Urbina and Tom had part ways right after Old MacDonald, and so I could kind of see the writing on the wall a little bit, and you know, the business was slowing down. There wasn't a lot of new projects being done, and I'd always done probably the majority of the consulting work for Tom ever since, you know, that was part of our deal when he hired me. I'm like, I still want to do consulting and restoration work, so he was fine. So I always did that on the side while I was running, you know, 18 old projects where we were busy. So just before Streams, I was pegged to run Stream Song, and just before that, he kind of came to me, and he goes, man, because I'm signing all these contracts, I don't even get to see these golf courses. You ever think about going on your own? And I said, well, yeah, I could feel that coming. And I go, this would be a great time. He goes, well, I was thinking the end of the year. I'm like, well, how about right now, just before I start Stream Song? And then I'm still your rep. I get a contract with Stream Song. I'm working directly for them. They're funding my company for a while, and I get to do all the consulting work. And so it worked out perfect for both of us. Cut his payroll. I still ran a project for him. Mm-hmm. So dear good friends with them, and see, you know, all the guys on the crew are still my best friends. But I also got to start my company with a basis of work, and then I took all the, you know, he says, take all your consulting with you. So I took all my clients with me. And so once Stream Song was done, even while it was being built, I was doing some bunker projects and rebuilding greens at clubs. So I already had a built-in business. So I've been happily and luckily busy ever since. I'm booked through like 2020 now.
Wow.
So I'm just have steady. I'm just a one-man crew, and I do my own shaping, and I just take on enough work where it keeps me busy and kind of projects I like to work on.
Awesome. Well, I won't take up any more of your time because I know you got an important project here at Tim Aquana that you're up here for. So good. Appreciate you taking an hour out of your day to inform us on your background and whatnot. That was some great stories.
Thanks really for having me.
It's been fun talking. That was a lot of fun. Cheers. Thanks.
Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!